You're listening to Energy Insiders, a weekly update on clean energy and climate policy with Renew Economies editor Giles Parkinson and leading energy analyst David Leach. Energy Insiders is brought to you by Evergen, providing cutting-edge energy management software for battery optimization, virtual power plants and distributed energy resources. And Pylon, helping solar installers and retailers design high-resolution solar proposals in minutes.
Hello and welcome to this latest episode of the Energy Insiders podcast. My name is Giles Parkinson. I'm the editor of Renew Economy, along with the EV-focused The Driven and One Step Off the Grid. And joining me as usual is ITK Principal David Leach. David, I trust you are well in this lead-up to the Easter break.
I am well. Thanks very much, Giles. I trust all our listeners are enjoying somewhat better weather for the most part, although perhaps not in Darwin so much, where I think our very interesting guest comes from today. And, as we look forward to future episodes of the podcast, I think we'll be going from Alice Springs to the USA to China.
Got all bases covered.
We have got a few bases covered.
Indeed. Well, look, there's been a couple of important things to sort of talk about this week, such as the new vehicle emissions standards, sort of repackaged by the federal government after negotiations with the car lobby. We'll get to that after our interview. And we've got some discussions about Eraring to sort of competing observations, one from you and one from some other analysts. So not necessarily competing, but complementary. But first, we're not actually going to Darwin, Dave. We're going to Alice Springs.
Oh, Alice Springs. Excuse me.
Alice Springs. Yeah, that's right in the centre of Australia, which is enjoying, I think, a very flooded Todd River at the moment. Alice has been a fascinating spot for the green energy transition. It was actually the site of the first utility-scale solar farm in Australia, or the largest ground-mounted in the Southern Hemisphere, as it was then, 12 years ago. And it's kind of been struggling with the transition ever since then. Anyway, we caught up with Lyndon Frierson. He is the head of Akistica, which is an Alice Springs-based advisory, and he works on a lot of renewable energy projects around Australia. And he was the project manager for something called the Alice Springs Future Grid, which was a project funded by ARENA, the Northern Territory government, and included all the sort of the state utilities and the regulators and things like that. Fascinating discussion about how to transform the centre of Australia into renewables. Let's have a listen to our interview with Lyndon. Lyndon Frierson, thank you very much for joining the Energy Insiders podcast.
Thank you, Giles. Great to be here.
Look, Alice Springs is a pretty interesting case. I remember visiting there a few years ago now. God, it must have been 8 years ago. Visiting yourself out at the Desert Knowledge Centre, as I think it's called. And
that's correct.
And the U-turn solar facility was the first, or it was the largest ground-mounted solar facility in the Southern Hemisphere when it was built in, what, 2012, was it?
Yeah, so when it was very first announced and got underway in 2012, we held that record for a very short period of time before being overtaken by Grenna River in WA with first solar, and that was a 5-megawatt array. But when we built that,
I'm going to correct you there. It was a 10 megawatt array.
It was 10 meg. Yep.
Yes, because I went out. I was there.
Well, look, it was a heady time for the industry, and when we went to market for the 1 megawatt solar array, it was the first time there'd been a utility PPA sort of reverse auction type model to go to market, and it was a project that was actually developed through the Alice Solar City program. Power and Water were the off-taker, and we were involved in facilitating that process. And so it was cool. It was at a point where one megawatt just seemed immense. And yet here we are all these years later, and 1 megawatt's a rounding error on what gets installed daily.
No, that's exactly right. Look, I had to ask you what the offtake price was for that very first contract.
Well, it was commercial in confidence, Giles. I certainly can't tell you. But look,
The ACT has actually published its auctions, and I think the very first one was about $180 a megawatt hour, which would have been around about the same time, actually, maybe a couple of years later.
They were a couple of years later. It was competitive for where it needed to be at the time, bearing in mind that we were offsetting gas and securing LGCs through that. I'm not sure it'd necessarily be still be in the money at this point in time. I'd have to ask other people about that. But it was, at the time, it was considered and it was taken on board as a commercial investment by Power and Water. Certainly, it did have Commonwealth government support to be able to get that project over the line in the first place. So, but it was a very different world from the one we inhabit right now.
Given that, I mean, it was like a sort of like a landmark project. Alice Springs was one of the very first and had the biggest in the Southern Hemisphere. Where have we got to now? Because this is the sort of the subject of this report that you've just done, the Alice Springs Future Grid Report. There's been an awful lot of rooftop solar adopted in Alice Springs, but it's still only about 12% of the generation share, I guess, in the local community. But maybe we should just sort of pause here and just reflect about why Alice Springs is such an interesting case study, because you've just released this report this week and just mapping out ways of reaching the target, the Northern Territory target of 50% renewables by 2030, which doesn't sound a lot in the general context of what Australia is doing, but these are small isolated grids with a whole heap of consumers in Alice Springs. I think there's 26,000 of them, which I think is what kind of adds to the complexity. But you've got big solar ducts and you've got layers and layers of regulation. Perhaps you better go from here.
Yeah, sure. Look, it's a great question. And I think even since we've released the report, there's been a number of people who've queried, looked at 50% doesn't sound like much as a target. 12% seems pretty low compared to everyone else. But I think the thing about Alice, there's a number of things that makes it different. It's a place I've called home for the best part of 20 years now. It is a peculiar location in that it is a completely isolated power supply with similar towns around the country. If I think about somewhere like Mount Isa, for example, which is a not dissimilar environment, a little bit wetter than we are, similar radiance levels, but it's anchored by a large mining load. So that skews the demand requirement in that site. Other locations of similar population don't necessarily have the same infrastructure that we have. So there's parts of the town that are quite large in what they do because we're the largest town for 1,500 kilometres in any direction. We're the only MRI for 1,500 kilometres in any direction. So there's these peculiarities around why Alice Springs is the town it is, and a large amount of it is to do with us being a service centre for a very large chunk of remote Australia. But coupled with that is the environmental constraints that we have a grid that needs to operate in an environment of, well, a summer like we just had, where we had consistently 3 months well above high 30s, low 40s every day, where nighttime temperatures are dropping down to sort of mid-20s at best, through to winter where we're getting, we might go for weeks where the temperature doesn't exceed 20 degrees during the day and it's regularly getting to zero overnight. So the environmental variation is actually quite significant over the course of the year. And you then overlay that with the fact that we don't have access to hydro power at all. We have, through this report, considered the opportunity around wind, and there is some opportunity around wind, but the economics aren't great around holding that up. It really leaves you in this world where solar is we've got this amazing solar resource there, but it actually starts to have a whole lot of challenges when you try and replace the entire demand within the town with solar. So I think to sort of go into the question that you started with, which is, well, why haven't we got more? The peculiarity of Alice Springs is a big part of it, but it's also that the problem we're trying to solve has changed considerably over time. When we set up Alice Solar City in 2008, and then the Desert Knowledge Australia Solar Centre in late 2008, and then the Crown Plaza PV system, which is the biggest building mounted PV system in the Southern Hemisphere, I think that was 2009, and then Eterna in 2012. When we did each of those things, the problem we were trying to solve for each of those projects was a lot more around, could this technology work, rather than does this actually fit within the overall pattern? So we were replacing very small amounts of energy. Where we've got to over time is everyone's got quite comfortable with the fact that this technology works, and economically it works really well because clearly householders are putting it on there. We've got 23 meg of rooftop solar in a grid that has a peak load in the middle of summer of in the order of 50 meg. But where things start to really get interesting around how things can't change further is that because of all of those sort of historical quirks around Alice's being a service centre and being this major region in the centre of Australia, the electricity supply for Alice Springs actually, when you look at the regulatory framework and the structures there, looks a lot more like the NEM than places like Broome in Western Australia, for example, where you have a vertically integrated energy supplier who in Horizon Power is the generator, the network operator and the retailer. In Alice Springs,
So I was just going to interrupt you there because it just seems a much more sensible sort of situation. You've got Horizon Power in Western Australia. They are the generator, they are the retailer, they are the network provider. They can make all the necessary decisions. How is it that Alice Springs ended up with this sort of layers of regulatory oversight of networks, generators and retailers? It's, you know, I mean, it's hard enough in the NEM, which big enough as it is. I mean, God knows how you do it in Alice.
Yeah, look, it's a great question. So that's the important thing to note is that what we have got in Alice is we have we are operated by, or we have the Utilities Commission that provides licences, and then we operate under a set of the energy rules that are a deviation from the NER but are based upon the NER with oversight from AEMO. We have a separate regulated network provider in power and water, where their charging and their cost recovery framework is all governed by the AER. We have competitive generation within the town. So TGen is the government-owned generator, but in practice, there are other generators such as Uterno and others who are able to connect in an open access framework. We have a independent system operator through an entity we call PwC System Control, who runs the network on a day-to-day basis in much the same way AEMO does. And then we have competitive retailers. The question as to why we got there, it's a bit of a historical quirk, and arguably it was done on the basis that we, for a very long time, the Northern Territory, did have a vertically integrated energy supplier in power and water. There was a view formed in the early 2010s that the future of energy suppliers, of government-owned energy suppliers, must exist in a world where they are broken up and regulated in much the same way as has occurred elsewhere around the country. That's happened in greater and lesser extents in places like WA, where they've fully broken that up in the southern areas of the state, but they've left that structured in the northern areas. And so when that breaking up occurred, PwC did retain control of the 72-odd remote communities through its division of IES. It also retained control of minor centres such as Tea Tree and Borroloola and Timber Creek. And Alice Springs is the second largest place in the NT, ended up on the side of the ledger that said, no, let's break it up, rather than being on the other side. I wasn't in the room when those decisions were made, and so I can't comment, but they were policy decisions of the Northern Territory government at the time.
Well, short of having the population of Alice Springs marching down the main street holding placards saying regulator out and vertical integration now, the fact that this exists has kind of sort of shaped the way that you've approached this report, hasn't it? Because you're thinking, I mean, you've got technology solutions and options, which we'll come to. But I think one of the underlying things about your report is that you're thinking, because of this situation, we've got to work out what we're aiming for, which is 50%, and kind of give options to get there and then work out how you can kind of collaborate, because it's...
Yeah.
And you're suggesting that this is actually a good model for the NEM, and you probably want to explain why as well. But so, yeah.
Yeah, so I think we started with the Future Grid project that I'm the project director of, and we established that as a basis for saying, what is the challenge we're dealing with here? And the challenge is ultimately a power systems problem. It's a system issue. And the system includes the poles and wires and the generators and all the rest of it. But the system includes all of the people and human elements of the system, including all of our consumers. And so we said, well, if the system is the challenge and managing the system into the future is the challenge, then we need to assume that the solution must be a system-based solution as well. And what we started to realise was that through a bunch of workshops that we'd done and engagement with a whole variety of different stakeholders, was that we didn't exist in a world of a benevolent dictator who could just wake up tomorrow morning and say, okay, we've made the decision, this is what we're going to do. We had to engage with a large number of consumers and private sector entities who had invested in renewables. We had to consider the large number of people who weren't able to invest in renewables because they had low incomes or were renting. We had to think about the existing asset base and the role of the Northern Territory. And we came to a conclusion, the future power systems were changing the nature of the relationships between the parties in the power system. And they're changing them in quite asymmetric ways. And that's one of the characteristics of disruption, is that you start to see an asymmetry in the influence of different parties within a system relative to their size or scale within that system. So individual consumers and consumers as a whole are starting to have an asymmetric impact upon the power system just by installing solar plants on their roofs of their house. And so a systems-based approach was going to be necessary. And so we developed the Future Grid project that started out with the idea that said, look, we know that lots of different technology solutions have been tested. People have done trials on grid-forming batteries and on VPPs and on different consumer tariff models and forecasting and all the rest of it. But what hasn't been done is a trial where you put them all together in a real-world environment where the messiness of day-to-day life actually is part of what you're having to fix up. Yeah, the messiness of having to deal with brownfield asset bases as well as greenfield when you're working on VPPs and so on. And so the project really brought all of those threads together and was a collaborative project that involved ourselves, Acoustica, Des Knowledge Australia, TGN, Power and Water, Jacana, CSIRO, Charles Darwin University, Azo Automation, GridCube, a whole range of different parties all working together to test that out. And the roadmap was then the consolidation in many ways of all the learnings, both the learnings of things that we thought we should do, but also the learnings where we came out and said, well, having done that, we now know we don't want to do that again. And to map out that path towards 2030. And what we came to realise and became really apparent during that process was just how urgent the situation was. And that while, to your earlier question, 12% doesn't seem like much, during the project, in successive repeated periods over successive years, we continued to hit periods of minimum system demand that were, and to be honest, were quite startling. To be in a power system where the assumed requirement is we always have three or four generators online to be able to deal with N-1 contingencies, etc., to get to a point where the aggregate load on the generators has dropped down to 5.7 megawatts, as it did in October of 23. And that is occurring at a world where the effective demand in that system is actually exceeding 30-odd megawatts. It tells you you're operating a power system for short periods of time, an isolated power system, no connection to anywhere else. You're operating that power system on greater than 80, 85% renewables. And at that point in time, those generators are operating at the lowest level of their individual stability curves. And so as we're developing the report started to move its language from, oh, this is a problem we have to deal with in the future, to, hang on, this is actually a problem we have to deal with now. And that started to highlight that while 12% as an energy value doesn't seem like much, from a power value, we were already on the cusp. And in fact, we were already dealing with the sorts of issues that AEMO is considering in the scale of the NEM to still be a couple of years away from where we are. And sure, South Australia's got to 100% on many occasions, but it's got to 100% on many occasions with a connection to the rest of the country. What we were dealing with is the sort of stuff AEMO's talking about the NEM dealing, sort of facing by 2027, where you have very, very high proportions of renewables in there, but we're doing it solely with solar. We're not doing it with synchronous generation from hydro turbines. And that creates a very unique set of challenges to deal with. But what we observed was that as we were trying to solve them, the barriers were the regulatory barriers and the challenges around bringing people together on that. The solutions we would start to identify would actually have applicability within the context of a far larger system such as the NEM, far larger by many orders of magnitude. But the way you would have to think about them brings many of those same points together.
So has there been a sort of agreement then from your sort of future grid report? Because you've mapped out sort of four different scenarios, and to sort of summarize them sort of roughly is that sort of it's varying amounts of solar. It's all going to be solar, basically. I think one scenario has a little bit of wind, but basically it's solar. And then there's a question about whether that's going to be rooftop PV or utility scale PV mostly. And then the second question is how much battery storage you're going to need. You're going to need a fair bit of battery storage no matter what you're doing, because you need that to sort of stock that excess solar during the middle of the day and to provide grid stability. But then you've got this other question about, well, do you calibrate the grid to go zero fossil fuels, therefore you can switch off those last generators, those gas and diesel generators, and allow batteries, presumably grid forming inverters, to manage the system and hold it secure and manage, you know, through the cloud bursts and things like that. Or you design the system to always have at least those three generators on, which ironically requires even more storage because you basically got to store even more of the excess PV for later on in the day. So does that second one seems to be the most important one. Is that a decision that needs to be made now before you start going adding in more solar
I mean, it's a great question. And it really comes about that we started the report doing exactly the same thing that everyone else does, which is, well, what's 2030 going to look like? And we had a whole bunch of workshops and everyone put their ideas on the table. And we very quickly realized that there was not a scenario that we could create where, having created it, we wouldn't publish it and immediately everyone would say, well, that's just ridiculous. We think it should have been this scenario. You've completely underestimated the role of EVs, or you've completely underestimated private sector investment in large scale storage, or you've overestimated this, you've over... And you just end up in an argument about what the future may be.
That sounds familiar.
Well, actually, it's very familiar, scarily familiar, that you're arguing about a prediction that the only thing I can be certain of is whatever prediction anyone makes is going to be wrong. Mm-hmm. Because we know, for example, and we use this within the report, we know, for example, the historical predictions around the uptake of residential PV have been consistently underestimating what consumers want to do. Mm. So we know that it's a fraught business. And so once we started saying, well, maybe we have to consider a number of different scenarios, and that sort of freaked everyone out because it just seems like four times more work. But as we started to test it, we actually realized that if we imagine 2030, there's the actual answer of where we end up to in 2030 exists in a solution space that's actually bounded by only a couple of key variables when you start to think about what the solutions actually are. The first variable is how centralized will your generating system be? Is it going to be very centralized or is it going to be very decentralized? And there are very strong advocates, as you would know, Giles, throughout the industry for being one or the other. It's energy democracy. The future is 100% of houses having PV, all the way through to large renewables developers who believe that the future is all really large solar and wind and battery plants. And so that's that question of, well, the boundary conditions are either very centralized or very decentralized. And then there's a question of, well, what happens to your existing generation? And that's actually starts to become pretty binary. Do you ever get to a point where you would be willing to turn the generators off? Yes or no?
Well,
we all sat in a room, and that was a pretty awkward conversation, to be honest, because we had system control and TGen in there going, so is there ever a world where you turn the gen sets off? Now, turning gen sets off is not actually that hard. It's turning them back on that turns out to be a lot more difficult in these things. But we came to realize, well, within the boundary, within that solution space, the question of whether or not you ever get a generator to turn like zero fossil fuel generation or not on one axis, and then on the other axis, either very centralized or very decentralized, within that, you cover the vast majority of the potential solutions you might reach or potential outcomes you might achieve by 2030. Within that solution space, someone can say, well, what about vehicle to grid? Absolutely, vehicle to grid, but that just sits in the very decentralized arrangement. Mm.
So it sounds like you've got some decisions that need to be made. When do they need to be made, and who's going to make them?
Well, that's where the report really started to work backwards, to say, well, let's look at all of those. And what we started to see as we looked at each of those solutions and each of those options and said, well, starting it with the end in mind, working back to where we are now, what are all the things you've got to do to get there? And you can imagine sort of the threads all move starting at 2030, all moving back to where we are now. And what you see is actually they all come to start to share very common sets of activities that need to occur over the next 2 to 3 years in particular. And those activities then start to say, well, if you have to do all of those things anyway for any of those circumstances, and then you continue to monitor the implementation, and at different points along the way, you get to milestones where you make a decision to go one way or another. So for example, if the residential PV uptake has not met a certain threshold by 2027, then you have to make a decision at that point in time to invest in large-scale renewables outside of residential and commercial industrial PV uptake or rooftop PV uptake, because that's the last point in time that you can make that decision and still have enough time to go and build and deploy it and still have it there by 2030. And so what you get in the roadmap is things that you need to do now while maintaining as many options as possible over that time. And in effect, you allow the market, be they individual investors or developers or the network operators or others, to say, well, we at a certain point in time, if we haven't got that level of stability sorted out, then we can't progress to that next one. So that decision has been made. And so the very particular things that we flagged as stuff that has to happen immediately is a body of work around emergency PV management. So it's a program that PwC is already starting to work on around working with large commercial PV users or PV owners with creating a framework to reduce the performance of their PV system at certain periods of very low aggregate demand. Initially to reduce any exports, but potentially to reduce the generation completely in order to be able to stabilise the grid. So we've sort of called that.
Well, that's the similar emergent thing. Yeah, that's the similar thing that happens in South Australia and is being rolled out in other states as well, is it not?
Yeah, exactly. But targeted more explicitly to commercial and industrial users rather than just residential. And we did a lot of work around what the scaling of that was, and partly because at a residential level, it becomes very binary and just turning stuff off is not a great outcome. And we have a large number of people in Alice Springs who are in low socioeconomic brackets, and turning off PV has a very material economic impact upon them. So there's a body of work around that. There's a body of work around the communication to consumers around exactly what's actually going on, because often it's assumed that the reason there aren't more renewables is because someone just doesn't want them, rather than actually explaining the scope and the challenge of the issue that's put in front of them. There's a body of work around getting grid-forming batteries and getting a couple of key grid-forming batteries, and we've identified locations for where they should go within the network. And there's other planning work that starts to take you towards being able to operate with the engines off.
And how's that sort of looking now? Just the general reception for this sort of transition to renewables, because I mean, Alice Springs has had a few blackouts in the last couple of years. There was one major one, which was quite extended, and ended up having a big inquiry. Sort of human fault and equipment failures were identified, but it took the scalps of the two most senior executives, the head of TGen and I think PwC as well. Forgive me if I've got that wrong. So is there a willingness or is there an enthusiasm still in the community to make this transition happen?
I think certainly the project has done a lot of work communicating with a whole range of different users through the town around what the barriers are and what the opportunities are. And I think the overwhelming sensitivity is people are engaged when they're informed. And so when you talk to users about conceptually an idea that said we might need to do some tests well in advance, where we will need to isolate your power for a few hours while we run these trials, and this is what the benefit is, largely you get no pushback at all. People are just like, there's all sorts of times where my utilities are turned off, someone's doing a repair on a water main or someone's doing a repair on a power pole. With notice, people are engaged. I think there's a lot of education that then comes out of that. Things like if we are progressing towards a world where we operate with zero fossil fuel generation, there's large-scale work around our protection and control systems that need to be undertaken, which is pretty boring for most people. They don't really care about it, but it's actually really critical to the stability of the system. And so there's work, and we have done this through the Future Grid project. We've got a public launch of the report where we'll be taking people through what all this stuff actually means, and hopefully in an engaging fashion, and why it's important to enable these things to work in the future, and what their role in it actually is. And we see that being a constant theme through all of the work, that consumers are willing to be a lot more flexible than we assume them to be when we give them a lot more knowledge and engagement with the assets. Most consumers wake up most days just wanting to get on with their lives.
Mm.
There's a small number of us who are very geeky, who look at our apps on our phones daily and are really keen on what our solar inverter is doing, what our battery inverter is doing, whether or not we can charge or discharge, and people willing to sort of trade and do all sorts of stuff. But all of the research in this space over now decades has shown that most users treat utilities as utilities. They're an enabler of the rest of their lives. So they just get in there and move on with it. So as long as they've got confidence, they're actually pretty relaxed about a lot of things. And certainly we found that out in our community attitudes. People are obviously sensitive to price, and we need to make sure that what's being proposed is not something that's going to cost them more. But we also have very high uptake of renewables on people's households, and we ran a trial in the program of putting solar and battery systems on public housing tenants, and these are some of the lower socioeconomic groups within the town, and saw the significant benefit that came to them as individuals as a result of having access to renewables on the houses. And we identified some of the structural barriers that existed that not occurring more broadly, and provided guidance around how that can be addressed. Consumers see the opportunity that is there. Businesses see the opportunity that is there, but they don't want to be blindsided. And they don't want to be taken for granted. And so what, for all of us in the industry, for all of us who care passionately about it, we all need to be conscious of not taking consumers generally for granted, or assuming that they all care about it the same way we do, and making sure that we give them the information and the access to the information that they are able to feel confident that the decisions being made are appropriate for the community.
So there's a fair bit of work that needs to be done, sort of, you know, sort of assessing the next move and the information systems and things like that. So just maybe sort of how confident are you going that you're actually going to get to 50% by 2030 and then possibly even move beyond that afterwards?
Yeah, look, it's going to be a challenge. There's no doubt that it's a challenge, and ultimately it's not my decision to make this work. I can certainly influence it as much as I can, but as I said at the start, this is a system and it requires all the elements of the system to work together to get there, and that includes government and the various different utilities who are involved and the government-owned corporations there, as well as consumers and industry to be able to support it. I'm actually pretty confident though, Giles. The reality is 50% is an interesting number, and I've noted already there's some people that are saying, well, that's far too low a target. You should be targeting something much higher. But as I've noted, the challenge is actually dealing with the minimum demand. Mm. If you can solve that minimum demand piece and you can solve it once, then you can actually solve it twice. So if I can manage in, say, mid-April, when we're getting in the middle of the back end of school holidays in Alice Springs in mid-April, temperatures have dropped, maybe getting to 25 during the day, not getting below 16 overnight. It's a pretty benign, not needing air conditioning or heating. No one's at school on a Saturday or Sunday, and that load is just dropping down. And that point in time, we're not getting any cloud. It's just PVs. Just working at some of its best. If I could turn off the engines for 1 hour on one Sunday afternoon, run on 100% renewables, and then at the end of that hour, I turn them back on, do you know how revolutionary that actually is for a regulated grid? Because once I've done it for 1 hour, I could have done it for 2 hours. In fact, I could have done it for 4 hours, depending on how much storage I had. And once I've done it on that first Sunday, I could potentially have done it the day before on the and I could do it the next Sunday. And actually, once you've solved the structural barrier to getting to that point, then everything after that is just a question of economics and like deployment. Have you built enough storage? Have you built enough generation? All the rest of it, that becomes pretty straightforward. But the psychological barrier of getting to that point, well, the psychological and the technical barrier of getting to that point, that's the bit you have to solve. But once you've solved it, you've crossed the Rubicon and you're into this new world where you say, well, now we know how to do that. Here are the conditions around how we can do that. And one of the scenarios we forecast suggests up to 1,500 hours a year of the engines not running. Mm. That's 1,500 hours out of 8,760 available hours in the year. So getting close to 20% of the time, the engines are just off, which is phenomenally scary in one respect.
That's 5 hours a day.
Yeah, but I've only got to solve it once. That's the thing.
And of course,
because once you can do it once, you can then actually replicate and deploy and work through all the rest of it.
And just to sort of recap then, I mean, because I guess you get mining operations which kind of do that already, but they're just like a single load, a single controllable load, largely because it's a mining company and they kind of control everything. But this is completely different because you've got so many different people and so many different businesses.
This is now 9,000 consumers and all the commercial industrial customers that are out there and schools and hospitals but facilities that have got significant security around them that have to rely on those power supplies. It's a lot of people who've got to be bought into that objective. And I think what for me is really telling, and I think one of the great joys for me of working on this project, was when you start to think about it in that context, when you start thinking about what would it take to turn the engines off, that is so antithetical to the way that most people have ever thought about power systems. Mm. That to have run a project and to have been part of a project team that included the owner of those generators and included the system controller or the AMO in the NT and included the network operator, to have all of them sitting in the room going, well, it wouldn't be easy, but if we did it, it would have to look like this. And then to be able to produce a report where two out of the four scenarios that we considered, and these are all were all agreed by the parties as being plausible scenarios, the two out of the four of them contemplate a world where we have zero fossil fuel generation. That's actually pretty remarkable. And I think it speaks to the level of trust that was built between the parties to be able to engage in those conversations. And so part of that, you'll note that in the those sort of immediate phase one activities, there's a lot of work we have to do around system requirements, technology options, and procurement pathways for ESS. We looked at the potential for batteries, for grid-forming batteries to be able to do that. We also recognised that if we weren't able to do that quickly enough, you may end up in a world where you have to utilise syncons. While that wasn't necessary, we weren't getting to a point of saying, well, the syncons are the only solution. We came to a point of going, well, this is what the battery is going to need to be able to do in order for us to avoid a decision where we use a syncon. And that's how we were able to maintain the engagement of all of those different stakeholders to be able to ensure that what we were putting up was not met with a no, because that's just not how we do it, but was met with a yes, but here's the things we need to think about. And then, so there's a whole piece of work around protection systems and how we deal with a power system that was operating with very low fault currents and what sort of work we'd need to do around that. That's what's exciting about it. And I hope you can hear the excitement in my voice about talking about it, because this isn't just me having come up with an idea and dumping it out there in the public. It is considered work by a broad group of people to come around and say, how would you actually make it work? And then once you've made it work, what are the implications? And the modelling, as I said, shows that the implications are potentially very significant, because you're imagining a world where up to 20% of the year, five hours a day, you're turning the engines off in one of our scenarios. And we've all looked at it and gone, yeah, that's plausible. That's like 10 years ago, if I'd suggested that, I would have been put into an institution of some form. People would just not have considered that as being a viable way of thinking about the power system. But we're now at a point where people are able to engage with that and think, okay, well, let's work to the yes, but rather than the no, and work through what are the implications.
Terrific. Look, I think we've probably run out of time, Linda, but look, congratulations to you and all the people who worked on it, including the Desert Knowledge Centre and Jimmy Cocking out there. A sort of a hello to Jimmy, who I met when I visited there many years ago, and all the other people involved in the project. And look, absolutely fascinating. And we look forward to seeing the next instalment. So, Linda Friesen, thank you very much for joining the Energy Insiders podcast.
Thank you, Giles. Thanks for having me. And look, I've just finished by just acknowledging both the funders of our work, ARENA and the Northern Territory Government, and the Commonwealth Department of Resources and Industry, but also the significant contribution made by all of our project partners, Power and Water, Territory Generation, CSIRO, Charles Darwin University, and a whole host of others, including DK and Acoustica. We couldn't have done what we've done, and we couldn't as a project have delivered that outcome without that that work, and also acknowledge the work of Mark Patterson and the team at Energy Catalyst.
Good on you. Thanks, Lyndon.
Thank you.
And that was Lyndon Frierson from Acoustica. David, you weren't able to join us for this interview, but look, it was a fascinating discussion. I mean, Alice Springs, as we mentioned during the interview, has been the subject of blackouts and headlines, and the investigation of those blackouts cost the two most senior energy executives in the state their jobs. The Northern Territory is still struggling to get to 50% renewables by 2030, which in the context of the grid sounds not very much, but basically this is a territory that depends largely on solar. So it's fascinating to see how they've got to this stage now, where the state utility is sort of agreeing, as Linton says, to, you know, on the likelihood that their fossil fuel generators could be turned off in the middle of the day. Yet in the rest of the territory, we've actually seen three or four solar farms, large-scale solar farms at Katherine and just outside Darwin, still not operating because the rules that were devised by the local utility there are so strict that they can't actually operate. So, look, fascinating insight into some of the problems away from the main grid.
Indeed, Giles, and it's interesting because you could come closer to home and look at embedded networks and see a whole series, a good idea that turns out to be not necessarily a good idea depending on the implementation. But when you speak about dependent on solar, I think you've been writing this week, it really caught my eye, about what's been going on in the USA, in California and Texas and in other areas recently. Why don't we talk about that for a second?
Yeah, look, it's interesting. As one person was noting on LinkedIn, one of the sort of the finances for the renewable energy industry, if you go back sort of a decade or so, people were talking about 20% intermittent renewables, you'd be laughed out of the room. It wasn't possible. But in California, we're seeing stages now where you're getting more than 100% renewables. That's including hydro, but I mean, it's mostly wind and solar, particularly in the middle of the day for 18 out of the last 19 days as we record this.
I think
this.
It's mostly solar. There's not really that much wind, is there, in California?
No, not much. No, it's mostly solar there. Although overnight, the combination of wind and hydro has actually taken it to 50%. So it's a really interesting development in that grid. And we're talking about the world's fifth biggest economy here in California. I mean, it's a big state with a big population and big industry. But not only that, we've seen Texas, which is the heart of the oil industry there. They've gone up to pretty close to 80% wind and solar over the last couple of days and sort of set new output records for wind in the sort of the 24 gigawatt scale and solar not far short of that. And even in the other grids, the Midwestern grid called MISO, the PGM, which is the Northeast, and New York also in the Northeast, and the New England grid, they've all set these sort of new solar records and some of them wind records and behind the meter solar records. So it's interesting to see that in the US we're starting to sort of see these sort of records sort of cascade down, and it's quite fascinating. And we've seen this, of course, in Australia, in South Australia, particularly, where you've got just rooftop solar getting to the equivalent of all 100% of demand in the local state.
Like we've often said, Giles, there's no really economic, I don't think, or even technical challenges in doing extremely high renewable penetration. It's all about the people issues. And it's interesting to compare the California and Texas. I'm not sure if it's changed from when I last looked at it a couple of years ago, but at that stage, both grids were sort of comparable in size to the NEM. Might even be bigger in California. I'm pretty sure it was. But consumers over there pay much higher costs than consumers in Texas per megawatt hour for the power that they consume. And as a result of that, consumers in California are quite frugal households with their power, and their actual bills, despite the higher cost per kilowatt hour, the total bill is less than in Texas, where Texans are very happy and probably need to turn the air conditioning on in summer and the heating on in winter. And they pay less per kilowatt hour, but end up spending more. So two quite very different political environments, two very different renewable energy environments. I think both have got a nuclear plant. I can't remember.
They both run about 2.5 gigawatts of nuclear. Actually, Texas might be slightly bigger. I think it might be about 3.5 gigawatts. But I'd actually point out it's not necessarily frugality, it's actually efficiency. And I guess that's one of the things that high prices do. It encourages people to put in more efficient appliances and be more efficient about the home. So you see the same thing in Germany and France. And we often hear, France has got cheaper energy, therefore nuclear must be cheap. But it's actually heavily subsidized. And their households are actually really inefficient. And they've actually got higher bills than Germany, because Germany has higher per unit prices, but they actually have smaller bills because they become really efficient in heating and
Giles,
and the
next,
other appliances.
Next, you'll be talking about grand designs and telling me about all the triple glazed windows in Germany, which I often look at enviously when Karen's got the show on. But perhaps we should move on and talk about the vehicle efficiency standards as another example of efficiency.
Well, yes. Look, agreement appears to have finally been reached between the Labor government, at least, and the car industry, or the bulk of the car lobby, or maybe you should just say Toyota. They've compromised on some of the proposals that were put out about a month ago. I mean, they were inundated with submissions. I can't remember how many hundred, or maybe even more than 1,000, were sort of sitting in Chris Bowen's study, and he, as usual, went through them quite studiously. They've made some concessions. The big ones are sort of to put some sort of luxury and expensive four-wheel drive vehicles away from the passenger sort of categorization into the light commercial categorization, and diluted the path to that they must follow on the emissions. That's the utes and things like that. And I guess you can understand politically why that's done. I think there's... It's interesting talking to people within the industry, actually, and the people who sort of negotiated this. The proponents for the vehicle emission standards are absolutely delighted that they've got this far, and it looks like we can get this into place, subject, of course, to the coalition, which is vowed to...
And the Greens, let's face
it. And the Greens, I was getting to them, and the Greens that might want that, you know, a higher standard and things like that. So it's interesting. I mean, they're absolutely delighted that they've got this far, and I guess it's a credit to Bowen and King that they have actually got this far. At the same time, there's frustration that once again we have to sort of dilute these standards to sort of accommodate people and certain.
And Giles, there's always have to worry about perverse incentives, like the fact that these big giant utes. Which I'm not always a fan of when I see them in the taking up 1.5 parking spots. The fact is, there's now a perverse incentive to actually encourage people into them because they have this lower standard.
And that's part of the problem, and it doesn't necessarily sort of encourage or accelerate sort of Toyota's own efforts or the other Japanese car makers. I mean, they tend to sort of provide most of the utes. And this does not necessarily actually accelerate their moments. I mean, it's really interesting that there's actually a local company in Australia which is actually converting Ford Ranger and Toyota Hilux utes and decide, well, if the big car makers can't be bothered doing it, then we'll do it for them. So
despite the perverse incentives and despite the fact that it doesn't go enough far enough, I think there was a genuine sense that it couldn't go quite as hard as the initial implementation. It was really asking for a lot in a very short space of time. And I must say, I'm with the group that thinks it's great that Australia has finally got a standard. And I suspect there are people within the Liberal Party, including people in the Liberal Party cabinet, who are probably very glad there's a standard as well, even if they don't say so publicly. And I want to congratulate, I do want to congratulate Chris Bowen for actually being prepared to make policy, and he's not just there to sit around and keep the other side out. He's there to get a job done. And he's got on with it in his own way. And I think that's something I'm happy with. But on another matter, Giles, on another matter.
That's fair enough. Look, there's another policy decision. What do you want to talk about?
Oh, that's exciting.
No, another policy decision is coming. Look, it has to be made soon, I would have thought. This is the future of Eraring. A couple of analyses coming out this week. One from Climate and Energy Finance, from Tim Beckley, and another one from your good self. And I guess the question is there going to be enough in the system to accommodate the exit of Eraring in August 2025? And if there is, what's going to happen to prices and things like that? And this must be the balancing thing from the New South Wales government, and I don't quite envy their task at the moment. They don't want to be seen to be sort of throwing away money to a coal-fired power station or to a company that's done actually bugger all to replace the capacity of its... of the generator it announced 3.5 years ago it intended to close, but it may find it's got no other choice. David, briefly and broadly, I mean, we've published your article, your analysis on this this week, and it's interesting stuff. Can you share the headlines?
Well, certainly. The point is, we know from what's under construction, it's unlikely that anything else is going to commence construction that could make a difference to when Eraring closes notionally at the end of 2025, and even if it was a bit later, quite frankly, because it takes 2 or 3 years to really to get solar and wind plants built from the time you get notice to proceed. So that's, we know what's going to be built, and it's quite clear that there's a lot of stuff being built in Queensland that will come online in the next couple of years. but there isn't that much in New South Wales, and nearly everything that's in New South Wales really is solar in the next couple of years, other than Rye Park Wind Farm, which is half commissioned already, and then eventually Yungula Wind Farm, but that's certainly after Eraring is due to close. So there will be enough batteries. There's lots and lots of batteries. It's incredible how many batteries are getting built, and they're all going to get commissioned in 2025, which I don't really believe. So there'll be enough power, but we're really going to be short on energy. We haven't built enough new renewable supply to replace the energy, you know, the 14, 15, 16 terawatt hours that Eraring delivers all year round, and particularly the 2 gigawatts that it typically supplies in the early morning and the evening. And so we do have the gas power and the batteries that can actually supply power at any half hour, but for the energy, we're going to depend, I think, heavily on increasing imports from Queensland. And I wouldn't mind getting a bit of a thumbs up that that's actually the way AEMO or someone sees it as well. Failing that, I think, and as you mentioned, Origin's been utterly hopeless at replacing Eraring. I'm sure they know what they're doing, and I'm sure their investors are quite happy, that shareholders, that they've gone into Octopus, which is an outstanding success. But in the end of the day, consumers in New South Wales need energy. Origin's customers need energy. And someone's going to have to supply it. And there's still, in my opinion, a gap to be sorted out there.
Yeah, well, just on Origin Energy, I mean, it's actually interesting that they've actually made a whole series of announcements in the last few months about sort of new projects that they've bought up in New England. They've bought a whole bunch of land up there to host a wind farm. There's rumours that they're going to be the buyer of the Yanco Delta wind farm, which is like 1.4 gigawatts and will be the biggest in New South Wales and probably in Australia, depending on the timing of other projects. But none of that will be built before Eraring is closed.
Yanco Delta can't get through until Humelink's built. You know, I mean, the Southwest Renewable Energy Zone, which is that great big area between Balranald, for people who've been out there, and say Narrandera, you can build. There are plans by very reputable developers to build up 6 to 7 to 8 gigawatts of wind out there. But it's got Buckley's chance of getting to the Sydney region until Humelink's built. And even then, Humelink will at best have 3 gigawatts of capacity. You know, really, if you believed in that southwest zone, I don't know why you wouldn't build 2 Humelinks right next to each other, 2 double circuits. And then you get not 3 gigawatts, which one double circuit can do, not 6 gigawatts, but 9 gigawatts of power could come in. And it wouldn't look that much different to one tower, don't you think?
It's a tricky one with transmission. I don't know about those twin transmission lines. I mean, we've just seen this sort of contortions being done by Transgrid already with its main transmission link in New England, which has sort of been diverted. And my understanding is it's running right through the middle of the Barnaby Joyce properties, or his family's property, which is possibly one of the reasons why he seems opposed to it. Although there's
he'd get the money, he'd be quite happy.
Well, you would have thought so, but maybe he's playing a clever game. Who knows? And look, they've also announced a sort of a rerouting of the VNI West to sort of go around sort of, you know, some towns and other places and yet still trying to sort of negotiate their way through the start and the end of the project. So it's proving quite problematic, and nothing like that is going to be happening quickly. Look, I just wanted to point out in Eraring that there is another view which has been put together by Tim Buckley from Climate Energy Finance, which is interesting, and in an article which will appear on Thursday, which is when you'll hear this podcast, but we're recording this a day before, but it's essentially it's just sort of looking at the costs of keeping the Eraring open, and Tim is arguing that it should not be kept open. He's quite, you know, he's acknowledging that it's probably going to be tight, but he argues that there's enough capacity there, and there will be, and that the costs, there's probably better things that the New South Wales government can do over the short term to help fill in that gap. And I presume he's sort of talking about more sort of distributed energy and things like that. So that's another credible, interesting point of view.
Yes, Charles, and I do think we do need to get more wind built in New South Wales. It needs to get approved, and I hope that a CIS contract and 6 gigawatts of that bids are due in June, which is not very far away now, but won't be awarded for 3 months. And then, you know, projects have still got to go out and do all the hard work about getting equity finance. So it will speed things up with a bit of luck, but we really need more to get done sooner. And certainly we need more wind farms getting through that New South Wales process. But also we need somehow to get the people who own the wind farms to actually, you know, commit, perhaps they're rationing or holding out or whatever. I mean, you know, I ask, Ungula Wind Farm could have got going ages ago, couldn't it really? The fact is that the LTESA contract that they got is really, as far as I can see, completely, I probably don't understand it, but I can't see what value it adds since essentially 100% of the output was contracted to Snowy anyway, at a higher price than the LTESA price. Anyway.
Good question. We should ask them sometime, I think. Look, just pointing out on that and on those matters, interesting, Ungula is owned by Squadron Energy, and they've actually sort of announced the intention to establish some sort of fund which would allow some sort of common ownership or community ownership, a share of the Ungula and the Spices Creek wind farms in the same way that they've done with a Sapphire wind farm further north. That was done under CWP,
I was offered because the people in New England didn't take it up, numbskulls that they are, and it was offering 5% for 5 years at a time when interest rates were pretty much 1% or zero, and it was a wonderful investment. I'm very happy to have had it in my portfolio.
Well, there you go. And look, we've also published a really interesting letter to renewable energy developers. This one comes from someone in the Central West who's actually really committed to the community energy and committed to renewables. And she's been a bit let down by some of the attitude of some of the project developers that have come in, talked to them, and the way they've either been largely dismissed, ignored, or just not handled properly. And I just think it's, you know, it'd be good for many people in the renewable energy industry, if they haven't already read it, to actually read this letter and maybe reflect upon it, because, you know,
we can still improve.
We can improve, yes. We should be fans of continuous improvement or something. What's that? Yes, I can't remember.
Yeah, that one, yeah.
That one. That one. Anyway, look, and you did mention embedded networks, and I'd sort of point out the recent episode of the Switched On podcast with Anne Delaney. Did a fantastic piece on embedded networks and some of the legal problems there, and why they're not delivering on some of the anticipated savings in those things as well. So that's pretty interesting, and there's been some great episodes there. David, I think that probably just takes us to the end of the road before Easter. So I think we'll sign off. We'll thank Lyndon Friesen for joining us earlier. Thank you, David. Thank all our listeners out there. And wish everyone a very happy Easter. Thank our sponsors, Evergen and Pylon, for their continued support. And we'll be back next week with another episode of Energy Insiders. Bye for now.
Energy Insiders was brought to you by Evergen, the market-leading renewable energy software business that optimises residential and commercial solar and battery systems. Evergen enables large numbers of systems to operate as a single fleet, so network operators can use them as a virtual power plant, generating significant value for consumers, network operators, and the energy system as a whole. Evergen software is powering the energy system of the future. Energy Insiders was also brought to you by Pylon. Pylon provides easy-to-use solar design software for installers and retailers with pay-as-you-go pricing, no monthly cost, and no locking contracts. Join Australia's top solar companies who trust Pylon to design high-resolution, CEC-ready solar proposals.